suppressed under the Ukrainian government, and as Russians, we were insulted in the streets. Now we will be able to live the way we want as part of the Russian Federation.
While Russia plays up the support it has from the local population, the West claims there is no support here for the invasion. The truth, like much of this propaganda war, lies somewhere in between. In order to understand Russia's war aims, it's helpful to look at a linguistic map of the country. Crimea, which Russia annexed 8 years ago, is overwhelmingly Russian-speaking, as is the eastern region of Donbass. The more Russia pushes westward and north from Crimea, generally the less support Russia will have from the local population. I took to the streets to ask people how they felt about their new governors, but not a single person would speak to me on camera. The pro-Russians are worried about reprisals from Ukrainians, and pro-Ukrainians worried about the authorities.
Now, I've spoken to about a dozen people, a dozen groups of people here. I'd say about 25% of them were openly pro-Russian, one of them taking a Z symbol out of his bag and showing to me a sign of support for the Russian army. I'd also say there's about 25% of people who are openly pro-Ukrainian, one of them asking to see my British press credentials before telling me his answer. But interestingly, the majority, around 50% of the people I spoke to, say they're more neutral. They don't really mind if it's Russian or Ukrainian rule here. One of the women I spoke to with a teenage daughter said she's got Russian family and Ukrainian family, and she just wants peace. So that's very much the majority view here, just wanting peace.
Many Ukrainians have also fled, not only the war, but Russian rule, meaning the demographics have changed. Some Ukrainians who've left send threat to those who choose to work with the new authorities.
Some people here are afraid. They're being told that the Ukrainian army will come back and imprison us or kill us. And they threaten teachers on the social networks. They demand we don't go to work, or when they return, they will put us in prison. And they send death threats to relatives.
No matter their political views, it's a nervous time for all civilians here. Not least because this being a tourist town, war is not good for business. There is also the threat of a Ukrainian insurgency. While this conflict has become a proxy war between Russia and NATO, most civilians here just want to get on with their lives in peace. Jenny Miller-Berdyansk.
After a 9-hour-long trip from the Afghan capital Kabul, we have arrived in Gayan district in southeastern Paktika province, where the 6.1 magnitude earthquake has destroyed more than 1,000 homes and left more than 2,500 victims. The residents have to stay outdoors in the cold weather, without access to basic needs.
All houses here have been ruined as a result of the earthquake. In some areas, all members of a single family have been killed. Currently, women, children and elders are in a very bad situation and need urgent help.
Next day, as the sun rises, we visit more quake-ravaged houses. People still continue the search and rescue operation. It seems like every home here has had some killed or injured.
Mr. Naim Khan says that he has lost two of his relatives and five others are injured. We asked him about this earthquake and about the situation here.
At around 1:30 a.m. Wednesday, the earthquake struck here. Two of my family members were killed and five others injured. We also lost our livestock. Our livelihoods and food supplies are buried under rubble. There's nowhere to go. We need help and our houses should be rebuilt.
Four of the Taliban ministers and aid agencies arrived in the collapsed villages to address the needs of desperate people. They're providing food items, blankets, tents, medicines, and other basic necessities. But it's clear more help is needed.
The leadership has ordered all related governmental institutions to reach the quake-stricken areas and take necessary measures. In addition, the Prime Minister is going to pay money to families of the victims.
Humanitarian aid agencies have arrived here to carry out the required programs. Based on our assessment, more than 8,000 houses have so far been confirmed destroyed here in Gayan. These affected people need help immediately.
The earthquake comes as Afghanistan is facing drought, famine, and hunger, triggered by cuts in global aid and the U.S. sanctions. The Taliban officials have called on the U.S. to release Afghan frozen assets. Rahmatullah Baghban, Paktika province of Afghanistan.
EU leaders held video calls throughout Tuesday to prepare for a summit on Thursday and Friday at which Ukraine and Moldova will be granted candidate status, which means they move a step closer to joining the 27-country bloc. Georgia will be placed to a stage just below candidate status. EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry, new global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc. In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework, but the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purizup, London.
Shedding tears of joy after years of longing for the chance to visit a land described as the land of revelation in the Holy Quran. Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, or the city of the Prophet, as it hosts the final resting place of the Prophet Muhammad. Direct flights from Iran arrive in Saudi cities of Medina and Jeddah and will continue until 4th of July. A large number of Iranian pilgrims will first stay in Medina for 6 days and five nights to visit the Prophet's mosque and the Baqi Cemetery, among other sites, before leaving for Mecca to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
Being in a place that the Holy Prophet Muhammad and her daughter Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had been is an amazing spiritual experience.
I've been to lots of holy shrines, but here I feel different. I feel absolute peace and detached from the world.
The outbreak of the coronavirus limited trips to Mecca and Medina for 2 years, with only a limited number of Saudi pilgrims being allowed to perform it over the period. Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, while many of them have been awaiting for as long as 15 years. Going around the Prophet's mosque, you can see Iranians overwhelmed with emotions, most of them describing their visit to Medina as a unique experience.
It's impossible to describe the atmosphere in the Prophet's mosque. You can't understand how it feels until you visit the mosque.
I feel God has bestowed His blessing upon me to be the pilgrim of the Prophet's tomb and be in this spiritual environment. It's truly exceptional.
In 2019, the last Hajj before the outbreak of the coronavirus, about 85,000 Iranian pilgrims visited Saudi Arabia. But this year, with the reduction of quotas in Islamic countries, nearly 40,000 people from Iran are allowed to participate in the annual event.
Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, and many more are on their way to get to this holy city. This is while many more Iranians, thousands, have to wait for at least another year so that they maybe get the chance to visit this holy city once in their life. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds' Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Drama Theater of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theater.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in. It's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered 3 bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick, due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are 3 floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside, that's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me is a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
The limelight.
Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address Israeli regime's action as such, says Emily Hacker, writer, in an article published under the heading, Israeli regime's assaults on public health infrastructure amount to war crimes. Stay tuned for more. In May 2021, the Zionist regime military dropped hundreds of bombs on the Gaza Strip, destroying houses, schools, businesses, and healthcare facilities. Perhaps nowhere was the human toll of that month more apparent than at Al-Shifa Hospital, the only hospital in Gaza equipped for emergency assistance. Doctors worked for days on end, rarely sleeping or eating and unable to see their families as they frantically treated hundreds of wounded Palestinian patients, at least those patients who could actually reach the hospital. Outside the hospital grounds, streets were so badly damaged by the Zionist regime's airstrikes that paramedics struggled to bring patients directly to Al-Shifa. In the span of those 11 days in May, the Zionist regime occupation forces wreaked havoc on Gaza's already precarious public health system, damaging or destroying 19 medical centers, including the offices of the Palestine Children's Relief Fund, a nonprofit that provides cancer treatments and medical prosthetics to children who are unable to seek care outside of Gaza due to Israeli regime blockade. The Israeli regime's military actions in 2021 were, unfortunately, nothing new. Numerous Israeli bombing campaigns have damaged or destroyed primary health infrastructure in the occupied Gaza Strip, including clinics and hospitals, as well as key public health services like water treatment facilities, sewage treatment plants, and electrical grids. This is not accidental. The Zionist regime relies on, among other strategies, the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, the targeting of medical personnel, and inhibiting Palestinian access to healthcare to enforce its regime of apartheid. Yet, Western health officials often overlook these acts, which are nothing short of war crimes, and this passive complicity violates promise as healthcare professionals to do no harm. The physical and mental health of the Palestinian people is a central component of Palestinian liberation and must be discussed as such. The Zionist regime's military offensives against Palestine have both created and exacerbated existing public health concerns within the occupied Gaza Strip and the West Bank. Beginning with the Nakba in 1948, the Israeli regime has made it a matter of policy to destroy not only Palestinian homes and communities, but clinics, hospitals, and other health infrastructure. Israeli airstrikes on Gaza in 2021 damaged or destroyed numerous clinics, a water treatment facility, and infrastructure related to COVID-19 testing and treatment. Nearly 2,000 Palestinians in Gaza were injured during the Zionist regime's May 2021 military assault, and hospitals were overwhelmed. The outright destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure, such as the bombing of a clinic operated by Doctors Without Borders, is accompanied by direct physical violence against healthcare personnel. The Israeli regime military have killed medical professionals, including doctors Ayman Abu Al-Auf and Mo'in Al-Aul in 2021, and paramedic Razan Al-Najjar, who was killed by Israeli snipers in 2018. Often, leaders and pillars of their communities, doctors killed by the Israeli regime military, leave behind both a physical and psychological void of healthcare and security. The actions of the fake regime of Israel and occupying military forces are indefensible by any interpretation and international humanitarian law, yet they are ignored at every opportunity by world leaders. In no other country and in no other war could such actions be left unaddressed by the Western medical community. Along with the destruction of Palestinian health infrastructure and the targeted killings of Palestinian healthcare workers, the Israeli regime imposes draconian restrictions on the movement of Palestinians seeking healthcare in Gaza and the West Bank. Medical travel permits are often delayed, lost, or ignored by Israeli regime occupation forces operating checkpoints out of Gaza. Figures from the World Health Organization estimate that the Israeli regime and military accepted only 54% of medical travel permits in 2017.
Blockades and checkpoints operated by Israeli regime occupation forces grossly impede not only the day-to-day freedoms of Palestinians, but prevent ambulances from transporting critically ill and injured patients. Despite the close proximity of the Israeli and Palestinian populations, infant and maternal mortality rates remain markedly higher for Palestinians, and life expectancy is almost 10 years shorter. The rates of stroke, hypertension, coronary artery disease, diabetes, and neonatal disorders range from 3 to 7 times higher for Palestinians as compared with Israelis. This is by design. The Israeli regime has removed or prevented the construction of systems of care and residences, denying building permits and demolishing homes. Living under a regime of occupation and apartheid carries with it a heavy physical toll, one that cannot be adequately expressed through statistics. Bodily integrity and bodily health are identified as key components to individual prosperity. The right of self-determination and Palestinian liberation are incumbent upon the general health of the Palestinian population, both of which the Zionist regime aims to destroy. The healthcare workers and public health personnel living and working under Israeli regime occupation are a testament to Palestinian strength and resistance, and public health officials in Palestine must have their calls to action echoed by their colleagues internationally. Outside of Palestine, healthcare professionals should be among the first to apply pressure to Western regimes to end funding absent a change of Israeli regime behavior and to condemn and uncover Israeli war crimes. Targeting the healthcare sector is a grave crime against humanity, and in further analysis of global health policy, it is imperative we address the Zionist regime action as such.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The United Nations has published its findings about the killing of veteran Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Akleh last month. It says it was Israeli fire that killed the journalist who was wearing a vest marked press while covering an Israeli army raid in the occupied Jenin. The UN probe suggests that she and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the significance of the report and its possible consequences for Israel.
The United Nations has confirmed what has been abundantly clear all along, that Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh was killed by Israeli fire.
Based on this very rigorous monitoring, we find that the shots that killed Abu Akleh came from Israeli security forces and not from indiscriminate firing by armed Palestinians.
Abu Akleh, a veteran Al Jazeera journalist, was killed while covering an Israeli army raid on Jenin in the northern occupied West Bank on May 11th. Multiple witnesses had already said that Israeli forces killed the Al Jazeera reporter. Investigations conducted by several media organizations have also come to the same conclusion. Al Jazeera and its host country, Qatar, pointed the finger at Israel from the outset. The killing also fits the pattern of Israeli violence against reporters and other members of the media. The Palestinian Ministry of Information says at least 45 journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since 2000. The UN Human Rights Office spokeswoman suggested that Abu Akleh and her fellow journalists were deliberately targeted.
At around 6:30 in the morning, as four of the journalists turned into the street leading to the camp, wearing bulletproof helmets and flak jackets with press markings, several single, seemingly well-aimed bullets were fired towards them from the direction of the Israeli security forces. One single bullet injured Ali Samoudi in the shoulder, and another single bullet hit Abu Akleh in the head and killed her instantly.
The UN expressed deep disturbance over Israel's failure to conduct a probe into the killing. It urged Tel Aviv to open a criminal investigation, not just into Abu Akleh's killing, but also all other killings and serious injuries by Israeli forces in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip. That is likely to be an impossibly long list. So far this year alone, the UN Human Rights Office has verified that Israeli forces have killed 58 Palestinians in the West Bank, including 13 children. The Israeli army says it's not possible to determine if its forces were responsible for Abu Akleh's killing. The murder sparked outrage from Palestinians and around the world, with thousands attending her funeral in occupied East Al-Quds. Yet that fury has yet to translate into concrete measure, particularly by international bodies such as the UN Security Council. And in the absence of such action, there is no reason to expect Israeli violence against Palestinians, whether journalist or not, whether well-known or not, will end anytime soon.
Well, joining us on tonight's edition of Spotlight, we have journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver, and professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, Muhaymer Abu Saada, joining us from Gaza City.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat in Vancouver. The UN says all the evidence points to Israel, and it was Israeli fire that killed Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Akleh last month while she was covering an Israeli raid in Jenin. Share with us your perspective on this UN report and its ramifications and consequences.
Yes, well, this is a repetitive situation. Almost Palestinians, since the beginning of the occupation of Palestine in 1948, and Israel have been carrying these kind of atrocities and murder against Palestinian journalists and writers. And Shirin Abu Akleh was targeted Palestinians across political line, including the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian Resistance Forces, Al Jazeera Channel, Palestinian journalists. They all say from the very first hour that Israel have killed Shirin Abu Akleh. Now, the United Nations, when they confirm the Palestinian story, like they do all the time, the question that Palestinians ask, so what is next? What is this international body going to do regarding Israeli crimes against Palestinians in general and against Palestinian journalists and writers? You know, Palestinians remember that Israel once had something called Golda List, referring to the Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. She had an entire list of Palestinian writers and journalists that they assassinated all across Europe, from Mahmoud Al-Hamshari to Majid Abu Sharar to Ghassan Kanafani in Beirut, and many, many Palestinian journalists were assassinated at the hands of this Israeli racist colonialist regime. So what are they going to do about it? Shirin Abu Akleh also is a U.S. citizen. What is the U.S. Position on this? And also there is a complicit, completely and shame, shamelessly, justification of the killing of Shirin Abu Akleh, particularly by the United States, who always take the side of Israel and cover Israel crimes in international body. So today Palestinians are asking the international community, what are you going to do about it? Every time you do an investigation about an Israeli war crime and you prove that Palestinians were right and the occupiers are liars, but then nothing happened. So,
sure.
So there is a feeling of anger and frustration across Palestine and across Palestinians in the diaspora.
Let's bring in Mr. Abu Saada on that issue as well. First of all, I want to get your overall perspective on the situation, but Mr. Barakat mentioned the United States. That was a question we had a little later on in the program. I'm going to jump to that question right now. On Thursday, 24 U.S. senators, they sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging that the United States be directly involved in investigating Abu Akleh's death, citing a lack of progress toward the establishment of an independent investigation. Also, the fact that Abu Akleh was an American. The letter said the U.S. government has an obligation to ensure that a comprehensive, impartial, and open investigation into her shooting death is conducted. The question is, will Washington be pushing for such an investigation? This does put the U.S. in a tight spot given the circumstances of the killing, doesn't it?
Good evening, and that is definitely a very good question. But if you could allow me just to make a short comment on the probe by the UN Human Rights Office before answering that question. Let me say that this is not the first investigation which has been reached the same conclusion that it's Israel and the Israeli occupation forces that killed Shirin Abu Akleh. CNN and other American media outlet have reached the same conclusion by saying that is it was the Israeli security forces. And one U.S. investigation by the media outlet has basically reached the conclusion that 16 bullets were fired at Shireen Abu Aqla, which one of them killed her immediately, and another one that reached or injured her colleague, Ali Samoudi. That is one thing. The other thing, let me say that the probe by the UN Human Rights Office was transparent, impartial, that the UN basically said that they have inspected photo, video, and audio material and visited the scene, consulted with experts, reviewed official communications, and also interviewed witnesses who were on the scene, that this is against the Israeli claim that there was a shootout between Palestinian militant and the Israeli occupation forces, and that's why Israel has refrained so far from conducting a criminal investigation into the killing of Shireen Abu Aqla. Now, answering your question, yes, since Shireen Abu Aqla is an American citizen, there is an outcry among many progressives in the Democratic Party in the U.S., and around half of members of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate has called on the president and called on the U.S. administration to get involved in the probe of the investigation, to get involved in the investigation of the killing of Shireen Abu Aqla. But unfortunately, the U.S. government or the U.S. administration has failed so far to take this case seriously, to put enough pressure on Israel to conduct a criminal investigation into the death of Abu Aqla. And unfortunately, the U.S. has very much acted as a country that who served impunity to Israel and impunity to the Israeli criminal acts against the Palestinians and journalists in the occupied Palestinian territories.
Mr. Barakat, a Palestinian probe, as we know, has found that Israel deliberately killed Shireen Abu Aqla. What message does this killing, was it intended to be sent by the Israeli regime? Is it a warning to journalists who want to report on Israeli crimes in the future?
It is absolutely the same message, and it is the same goal by Israel, and that is assassinating Palestinian journalists and writers and those who either carry the Palestinian narrative and stories to the world, or they are defending their own people with their words, with their creative work. And when Israel was shooting journalists in Gaza during the March of Return, marches for 18 months, they were targeting their eyes. They were turning them into blind. And we have tens and tens of cases of Palestinian journalists, camera persons, Palestinian short story and novelist writers. These people are always targeted by Israel because Israel doesn't want the Palestinian story to be told. And they don't want this story to be told by Palestinians. And they don't want their story to reach out to the world. But it always, Israel fails of killing Palestinian journalists and writers because they become immortal for our people, and more people will know them, and they become a conscious of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement. And that's why we are going to be organizing international workshops to expose Israel target killings of Palestinian journalists and Palestinians in general. I do not differentiate between assassinating a Palestinian journalist or assassinating a Palestinian student leader or a union leader or a Palestinian fighter or a leader in the resistance. Israel targets all Palestinians regardless of the way and the shape they struggle. Regardless of the way you struggle against this occupation, Israel will target you. And this is the Palestinian historical experience with the colonizers for the past 100 years. Britain, when it ruled Palestine, killed so many Palestinian journalists and writers as well. Israel is doing the same thing. In fact, Israel is using British law in order to criminalize Palestinian journalists and keep them in administrative detentions. Hundreds of Palestinian writers and journalists are today in Israeli prisons. Mm-hmm. They still do every chance they have to write and to get their material out of prison and to be translated and their stories to be told. And it is really a task of our struggle and not something, foreign for us.
Mr. Abu Saad, our guest in Vancouver, he phrased it very nicely. He said that Israelis will target Palestinians regardless of the shape and form of their struggle. The Israeli forces even took it a step further when they beat mourners carrying Abu Akleh's body during her funeral procession. Unpack what happened on that day for us. Was it again the Israelis using vicious tactics and fear-mongering against Palestinians, in the words of Mr. Barakat, targeting Palestinians regardless of the form of their struggle?
Well, let me say that Israel, unfortunately, is acting like a country above international law. And unfortunately, the impunity which has been provided to Israel and the Israeli occupation forces by countries like the U.S. and U.K., United Kingdom, unfortunately, that has allowed Israel to go without any kind of punishment. What the Israeli occupation forces has done to the funeral of Abu Akleh is very much telling us that Israel doesn't care for international public opinion and doesn't care for any UN criticism or any UN investigation. Israel claimed that that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty, and they were trying to deprive the Palestinian from raising the Palestinian flag in the Shireen Abu Akleh funeral on that day, which led to clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces. And let me tell you, that day was very much, instead of Israeli claims that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty, on that day the Palestinian people liberated East Jerusalem from the Israeli occupation. That was the longest and the biggest funeral that East Jerusalem has ever seen, maybe since the death of Faisal al-Husseini about 20 years ago. So unfortunately, what Israel is trying to do to submit the Palestinians, to deprive the Palestinians from their self-determination and from their political rights, and what happened, it was a backfire that the Palestinians succeeded in raising the Palestinian flag all over Jerusalem on that day and made Jerusalem a Palestinian sovereign city instead of Israeli claims that East Jerusalem is under Israeli sovereignty. But let's go again back to what the international community has done to punish Israel. Unfortunately, the UN system, the international community, hasn't been acting as impartial or transparent when it comes to Israeli violations of international law, when it comes to Israeli war crimes, which has been documented by prestigious international organizations like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, who have basically indicated that Israel is implementing an apartheid system against the Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israel has succeeded to go without any kind of punishment because of the impunity which has been provided by governments like the U.S. government.
Mr. Barakat, Israel has in recent months intensified its attacks on the in the occupied territories. Jenin has been the hardest hit following a series of anti-Israel operations by Palestinians there. There were also some reprisal attacks against Israelis even in the heart of Tel Aviv. Give us your perspective on the significance of these operations as Palestinians have been venting their anger at the regime's crimes and occupation.
Israel recently is definitely escalating its crimes against Palestinian people in Palestine, in the West Bank, particularly in Jenin, And also, Israel is escalating its aggression against the region in general. We saw that they destroy the Damascus airport, for example. They are, continuing to pose threat against Lebanon. Israel, what is, they're doing now at this time is they're trying to run away from their internal crisis. This is a regime that cannot find a suitable administration for its affairs. The Israeli internal front is shaky. They are divided. They don't know which direction they're going. Israel in the past used to be able to justify its project for their imperialist and colonialist backers. But today, Israel have no project, and it's reaching its dead end. And the more Israel commit crimes against Palestinians, the sooner Israel will end as a Zionist settler project in Palestine from the river to the sea.
Mr. Abu Sada, your final thoughts on the issue as well. You can address what Mr. Barakat just mentioned, as we're going to have to wrap up this show pretty soon.
Thank you. Well, look, the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people has been going on for the past 74 years, since 1948, when Israel expelled more than two-thirds of the Palestinians from their own villages and their own homes. And this Israeli criminal acts against the Palestinians continued since the occupation of West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem in 1967. For more than half a century that the Palestinians have been living under Israeli occupation and have been deprived from self-determination. Gaza, the house of 2 million Palestinians, has been living under extreme Israeli siege and blockade. And let me tell you that no day goes by without Israeli occupation forces or Israeli settlers are killing Palestinians. Just 2 days ago, an Israeli settler in the West Bank city, village of Iskaka, stabbed a Palestinian youth and killed him. A Palestinian in the age of 27 was killed by an Israeli settler, and the Israeli occupation forces didn't even intervene to protect the Palestinians or to allow the Palestinian medics to take that Palestinian patient to the hospital. He was taken to the hospital and died there. Israeli atrocities and Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people is going day after day, and unfortunately, the Prime Minister of Britain, Boris Johnson, is saying that we will not allow the ICC to prosecute our friend Israel.
Okay, I'm sorry,
Israel has been provided and granted impunity from countries like U.S. and U.K. Thank you.
Apologies, I'm going to have to jump in there. We're fresh out of time for this program tonight. Journalist and activist Khaled Barakat joining us from Vancouver. Mohaimer Abu Sada, professor of political science at Al-Azhar University, joining us from Gaza City. Thank you very much. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.